made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Our first paragraph there, the very first two words, good judgment, a careful sense of timing, courage, and prudence. These are the qualities that we shall need when we take step 9. After we have made the list of people we had harmed, have reflected carefully upon each instance, and have tried to possess ourselves of the right attitude. Attitude is so important in this step. Whether we're doing it because it's the Mickey Mouse thing to do, because we are told to do it, all right, we'll go out and do this. And if that's our attitude, we're not going to do as thorough and as good a job, and we're not going to get the feeling from it that we will get if we have that right attitude. Look, I owe these people. Whether I did them what I considered little harms, how do I know that? I don't really know the extent of the harm that I did them. And so much of my harm was done when I was sober. When I was sober. Because I learned pretty quick to do the light drinking at the officers' club and the heavy drinking after I got home and my man went to bed. That's when I would slip quietly out and go get into my supply. No, the harm I had done people, a lot of it was done when I was stone cold sober. And I didn't know what this step was all about in the beginning. I thought it was the harm I had done people when I was drinking. That right attitude in which to proceed, we'll see that the making of direct amends divides those we should approach into several classes. There will be those who ought to be dealt with just as soon as we become reasonably confident that we can maintain our sobriety. There are those to whom we can make only partial restitution, lest complete disclosure do them or others more harm than good. There are other cases where action might ought to be deferred for a little while, do some more good judgment thinking, and still others in which by the very nature of the situation we shall never be able to make amends, direct personal contact at all. Most of us began making certain amends of kinds of direct amends from the day that we joined Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's true. Our families, the people that loved us. Even though I wasn't a booming success for the first 4 years that I was in, each time I would go back, it gave my husband a little bit more to hang on to, and he was hanging on by his fingernails. And as I said, not because of the drunkenness, because or drinking too much. It wasn't all that big a deal in the service. That's, you know, you went to a party at the officers' club, and that was the main object, was to party. And so it wasn't that wasn't the thing that was disturbing him. The change in me when I was sober, the change in my outlook on life. He told me one time, he said, "You know, Willie, I really don't know why you drink at all. Because you're not yourself when you drink." Now see, he was talking about he had married somebody real outgoing and fun-loving. I love to dance rather than eat, and I love to eat. But I love to dance, and I'm on that dance floor, and I like to party. I can party, of course, a lot better now than I used to. But I like those good times. And he'd say, "You know, you withdraw." And I did. It started working not as a thing that I was doing because everybody else was doing it. And I loved everything that went with drinking. I loved the little bars. I had, you know, been born and raised there in Texas and gone through college in Texas, and I had started teaching there in Houston. And then I met my man and married him. He was stationed at Scottsfield, Illinois, right across the river from St. Louis. And man, he moved me into a world that I had just seen on that big silver screen. And I just thought I had died and gone to heaven is what I thought. But, and the partying and the getting all dressed up and going to the clubs and the little combo sitting over there in the corner and the smoke so thick you could just cut it with a knife, and I loved everything about drinking. And it was the first time, of course, I'd had homebrew back in Spring, Texas. Everybody made homebrew. You can't find a good bunch of Germans that you don't find a good bunch of homebrew back in those days. The preacher didn't get up and, you know, preach against the evils of drink because he made good homebrew. Some people, when they hear my story, I get halfway through it and I haven't, you know, mentioned any drinking, and they think I might have stayed in one room and they squirted it to me through the keyhole. But no, drinking just wasn't a big part of my first years. It wasn't a big part of my life. But then when it got to be where I put it into my system on a regular basis, that's when the allergy manifested itself. And that's when I began to change. And change basically, instead of the outgoing person that I was. And when I thought, you know, I haven't really hurt anybody. What harms have I done people? And thorough reading of this step in both the big book and this book too, in this 12 and 12, gives us a little better idea of what kind of harms that we have done people. It gives us the suggestions as it does in the big book. Most of us begin by making certain direct amends when we join Alcoholics Anonymous. The moment we tell our families that we are really going to try the program, the process has begun. And see, I didn't mean it, but it gave him something to hang on to. And each time I would slip, I'd say, I'm going back to meetings again. Then that built that hope up a little bit more. So I was making amends in a way, even though I didn't mean to. They were false amends in the beginning, but the fact that I did keep going back and going back and going back did mean an awful lot. And it was the beginning of the amends. We want to come in the door shouting the good news. After coming home from our first meeting, or perhaps after we finish reading the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, we usually want to sit down and with some member of the family and readily admit the damage that we have done by our drinking. Almost always, we want to go further and admit other defects that have made us hard to live with. This will be a very different occasion, and in sharp contrast with those hangover mornings when we alternated between reviling ourselves and blaming the family and everyone else for our troubles. At this first sitting, it is necessary only that we make a general admission of our defects. It may be unwise at this stage to rehash certain harrowing Good judgment will suggest that we ought to take our time. While we may be quite willing to reveal the very worst, we must be sure to remember that we cannot buy our own peace of mind at the expense of others. And that's where the good judgment. Bill showed good judgment, didn't he, when he put this clear over at the ninth step. Because we've done so much so far. We've dug out some of these things. We've gotten ourselves into a position where the good judgment, as good as we can muster, and it didn't say perfect judgment, just as good as we can possibly do, is a little bit easier by the time we get to step nine. We've had some experience. We've already done a lot of amends. When we're going through these steps and really trying to change our life and little things, our attitude and everything is beginning to change, then we've made a lot of amends. But in this, in our steps 6 and 7, we become aware of those things that made us do it. the defects that have crept into our character, that a lot of them we didn't even know they were there. That hatefulness. There's another word us gals use, and you men do too. But the hatefulness that women can have, and the sarcasm that we can use, as I say, to cut people down. We don't think about that as harming other people. In the beginning, I kept thinking of the big ways. I'd never run over anybody. I'd never, done anything big. I wanted something big to deal with here. Not realizing that really the big things were not the things that were eating my soul up. That's not where the soul sickness was coming from. It was all those little things that I had become. With the not having confidence in myself anymore, I wanted to break yours down. I wanted to get to you. And these were little pieces. It was attitude as much as anything else. When we make these amends, I can assure you, if you're putting off this step and dreading it, if you're helping somebody else to get through it, try to tell them that they're going to gain a lot more than they give. Because a lot of these people really weren't harmed as much as we were harming ourselves. Women were used to being cut down by other women. So it wasn't all in big deal. But see, I had to go tell them, I wasn't very careful. And I'm sorry if I said anything that was unkind. This did me good. And after all, that's what we're after. That's what we talk about, newcomer, when we talk about this being a selfish program. Because by doing this direct amends, making that list and then taking it and dividing it into the categories where it belongs, that's where we really begin to start feeling good again and a little bit more confident. And seeing that this is the path that we really want to be on. We don't want to be on that muddy road anymore. We want some smooth driving. Okay, let's go over to step 10. Our principle there is perseverance. Oh my. Keeping on. That's a quality. That's a principle that we want to carry into all of our affairs. And by the time we get to step 10, these are our growing steps, 10, 11, and 12. These are the steps that we grow on. I hope I always stay green in Alcoholics Anonymous, because green things grow. I hope I never get to the point where I think there's no more that I can possibly learn about this program. Because if I go at it in the attitude of this is a way of life, and if I can keep my enthusiasm, nothing great was ever achieved without enthusiasm. It overcomes discouragement. It gets things done. And furthermore, it's contagious. Foist it off on other people. Have that enthusiasm for life, for this program, for the new things that you found and the new ways you found to do them. And that enthusiasm, I know, it enables me to get things done when I don't think it's possible. But just to bow my neck and say, I'm going to get it done. Dennis has done a good job. And all the people that helped him here by just bowing their necks and saying, we're going to get this done. It's something you wanted to do. And it's a big job. I know how big this job is. To put something like this on. Whether it's a small function or a medium function or a big old function. There's all these little details. But having that perseverance to just keep on doing. Continue to take your personal inventory. And when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. And boy, on that one, my ring around word is promptly. That's the one that I have to look out for. But when we get to our growing steps here, Bill Wilson gave a talk out in San Francisco one time, and he made a statement that I went up and questioned him about later because it just wasn't quite clear about it. He said, "Better is the greatest enemy of best." He said, "People come to AA and they quit drinking and they get better. And they settle for that. And they don't ever get to be their best." Because all he had said in the talk was that better is the greatest enemy of best. And when I questioned him about it, he added that. People come to AA, they quit drinking, and they get better. And they settle for that and don't ever get to be their best. There's where my greed comes in real handy. Because I want to get better and better at my program. Because I'm in the autumn years of my life. And I want to go out as happy as I am now. You know, we look around so many times for things to be grateful for, and we think of big things. I look out at the ocean, and it's a beautiful sight, and sunsets. And when I was coming in on the plane yesterday afternoon, that sunset was absolutely beautiful. And, you know, be grateful for big things like that, and for our health and all that. But I have to remember that what's really more important for me is every day of my life to be grateful for the little things. All those little things. Now I'm grateful that wrinkles don't hurt. Good Lord, what if they did? Oh, just think about it. Terrible. This program encompasses so much. When we take this inventory on a constant basis, and it talks about the different kinds of inventories that we take, but that one at night before we go to bed in our quiet time in the evening, when we really check up on, say, you know, Willie, how'd you do today? How did you do today? Did you hurt anybody? Did you add anything to anybody's life? Small thing, small, small. I don't do many big deeds for people. You don't have that many opportunities, but little small things. Telling the girl in the drugstore that color looks pretty on her. Little things. Did I do that? And if I did do anything wrong, am I willing to promptly, I know what Willie will do if she doesn't do it promptly. Bill picked his words very carefully. Promptly admitted it. If I do something that I know I ought not to have done, and you let me fool around with it for a while, it ain't my fault at all. It's yours. If you wouldn't have done that, I wouldn't have did that. And I think that's a universal human trait. When I was teaching, I put up little signs every Monday morning with what I called, and the kids got used to it. My high school kids would come in looking for the sign, for the new sign on Monday. And I would put these wise old Indian sayings, I called them. And of course, it was nothing but AA philosophy. They just didn't know it. But one of them I said, you know, when you make a mistake, quick, blame somebody. Because we talked about these. They wanted to, bam, what do you mean by that? So it gave me an opportunity to tell them, you know. I even brought in a little cartoon that I had found, and I had it blown up, and it was Humpty Dumpty, and he was sitting there with the psychologist, and he said, "But I didn't fall, I was pushed." And see, that's a human trait. It's that when we do mess up, we look around to find somebody who pushed us in the mess. Because somebody, I'm too up there to get in this mess by myself. I got to blame somebody. But that promptly took care of that. When Rose and I went through it, she said, you know, Willie, that's a real important word. I told her one time, I said, Rose, I was a little bit snippy with the, I don't know whether it was cleaners or the drugstore or grocery store or where, but I said, I'm a little bit snippy today. But after I got to the car, I turned around and went back and told the girl that I was sorry. And she said, you did what? And I said, I turned around and went back and told her I was sorry. Well, now, wait just a minute, Willie. Let's read that step 10 again. Because I wanted her to be real proud of me that I had admitted that I was sorry. And she said, let's read it again. It says, when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. She said, Willie, it'd been a lot better. It's easy to tell people you're sorry. But it's a little bit harder and a little more character building to say, I was wrong. You remember the Fonz? The Fonz couldn't get out. You know, remember when he used to say, I was wrong? He couldn't get out the word wrong. That's so much harder to get out than I'm sorry. God, we said we were sorry thousands of times over and over and over when we were drinking. But saying I was wrong, dead wrong, I should not have been rude to you. Rose knew that that'd make a better person out of me. And that's what the step says. Promptly admit it. Wrong. And that helped me to, come on, Willie, get down off that high horse. That saying I'm sorry, that's dodging the issue. But just saying, you know, I was wrong to say that, hon. I'll make sure I'm not rude to you again. And whether she accepts it or not, or he or whoever I'm dealing with, is not important. It's just important that I do what step 10 tells me to do. It says, as we work the first 9 steps, we prepare ourselves for the adventure, there's my word again, of a new life. But when we approach step 10, we commence to put our AA way of living to practical use, day by day, in fair weather or foul. Because that's what life's going to do. There's going to be fair days. We all happy this weekend. We're here protected. We're having a good time. And then each one of us Sunday, we go back into the jungle. We go back into the real world. And in your living, you people that are new, you're going to run into lots of foul weather. Because that's what life is all about. See, God found out he was real wrong in the very beginning. He put Adam and Eve in this paradise. They had everything. Everything they wanted. Their heart's desire. Everything was right there in that paradise. What'd they do? They blew it. So when he fashioned us human beings, he knew that we had to have some foul weather. That things couldn't be just paradise. Because if we did, you know, if we had everything, just think, if we were happy all the time, you know, those kind of people that are happy, 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 happy all the time, they got them locked up. And the walls are rubber, you know. That's not life. That's not living. We have a program here that's going to see us through fair weather and that foul. If you doubt it, stick around long enough. Watch some of your people walk through what they have to walk through. That they're not the least bit prepared for. That never in their wildest dreams could it have happened. You have friends going through things now that are rough. I hope they're drunks that have gotten into this program and sobered up. We have the tools to deal with that foul weather. And so many people, God bless them, don't have it. A lot of them find those tools in their church. A lot of them have those tools and use them. And they are ready for them. But we lost our hammers and nails and boards and everything else along the way. But with the tools of this program and the attitude towards life that we can develop and put it to practical use and stay sober in that fair weather and foul, he said, and then comes the acid test. Can we stay sober, keep an emotional balance, and live to good purpose under all conditions? A continuous look at our assets and liabilities and a real desire to learn and grow by this means are necessities for us. We alcoholics have learned this the hard way. More experienced people, of course, in all times and places have practiced unsparing self-survey and criticism. For the wise have always known that no one can make much of his life until self-searching becomes a regular habit, until he is able to admit and accept what he finds, and until he patiently and persistently tries to correct what is wrong. I've sat in AA meetings a lot of times, and a newcomer, maybe not brand new, but maybe they've been there for a good while, and they'll say, "What y'all talk about this dry drunk business? What is a dry drunk?" Okay, we go around the table, and everybody explains what they think a dry drunk is. It's in the book. We're just fixing to read about it. So when it comes my turn, I grab my little 12 and 12. I have one that fits in my purse, the smaller one. And I say, well, let's see what the 12 and 12 says about a dry drunk. And then maybe if you have any questions, let me know. When a drunk has a terrific hangover because he drank heavily yesterday, he cannot live well today. But there's another kind of hangover which we all experience whether we are drinking or not. And that's the emotional hangover, the direct results of yesterday's and sometimes today's excesses of negative emotions. And look what they are: anger, fear, jealousy, and the like. If we would live serenely today and tomorrow, we certainly need to eliminate these hangovers. Now, that doesn't mean that we need to wander morbidly around in the past. It requires an admission and correction of errors now, immediately after we make them. Quick, quick, quick. Our inventory enables us to settle with the past. When this is done, we're really able to leave it behind us. When our inventory is carefully taken and we have made peace with ourselves, the conviction follows that tomorrow's challenges can be met as they come. That's the old accumulation theory. If we don't let our washing girls, you know, stack up day after day after day after day, if we don't let the garbage sit in the kitchen day after day after day, if we take that garbage out, if we get that washing done, the house smells a lot better. If we take care of this just like we do with our life inside of us, just like we do our other life, tend to stuff as quickly as you can. That doesn't mean you have to stop traffic and jump out in the middle of the freeway and do it. You know, I want to take everything to the extreme. It just means that tend to that as soon as they come so they won't pile up and make us cross and irritable and discontent. Because that's what they'll do. You pile one on top of the other. And by correcting them promptly, by admitting them promptly, see why you did it, am I getting off the track a little bit? That's what they're talking about. As they come. Although all inventories are alike in principle, the time factor does distinguish one from another. There's the spot check inventory. taken at any time of the day, whenever we find ourselves. And look what it... Oh, goodness, this is such... Bill used words so well. When we find ourselves getting tangled up. Isn't that a good way to put it? Because, see, some days I feel like a spool of thread or a fishing line. That, man, I have attacked that spool. You know, I have really jumped on that thing, and I'm going to get it straightened out here in nothing flat. Doesn't work. I can't allow myself, because all I'm doing is getting more tangled. I have to do it patiently, correct where I've gotten it messed up here, correct where I've gotten it messed up here. You fellas with your fishing line, you know how it is when you pop it out there and it's just blah, 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 blah. And if you grab that thing and attack it, but no, you're going to get it more and more and more tangled. That's why we don't let it accumulate. You stop that fishing line just as quick as you can, and if we see our spool of thread getting tangled, we stop it. Our ball of yarn, whatever. But I think his use of the word tangled up, that spot check, whenever we find ourselves getting tangled up, we can step back and think for a minute. God, don't we hate to do that. Lord. Step back and think before we act. This is not a regular reaction out of us. We like to act and then think about how we wish we wouldn't have acted. But there's the one that we take at the day's end when we review the happenings of the day, hours just past. Here we cast up a balance sheet, crediting ourselves with things well done. And I hear people say, you know, well, it's not good for you to, you know, put anything on that credit side. You're just blowing smoke there. No. I've got to stop every once in a while and say, Willie, you did good. You did good, hon. I'm glad you took the time and the patience. You did a good job. I have to do that. God's trying to change with me, and I know He's doing it. And when I say, Willie, you did good, I'm really telling God, see there, God? You're helping me, and it shows. And if I, you know, that's not making a big brag out of it. That's just knowing when I've done, when I've been bad and when I've been good. And I'm glad the book tells us that. And chalking up debits where due. Then there are those occasions when alone or in the company of our sponsors or spiritual advisors, we make a careful review of our progress since the last time. Many AAs go in for annual and semi-annual house cleanings. Many of us also like the experience of an occasional retreat from the outside world where we can quiet down for an undisturbed day or so of self-overhaul and meditation. On down in that next paragraph, it says, the emphasis on inventory is heavy only because a great many of us have never really acquired the habit of an accurate self-approval, appraisal. Once this healthy practice has become grooved, it will be so interesting and profitable that the time it takes won't be missed. For these minutes and sometime hours spent in self-examination are bound to make all the other hours of the day better and happier. That's what I'm after. And at length, our inventories become a regular part of everyday living rather than something unusual and set apart. See, I'm taking an inventory when that man does cut me off on the freeway. Or woman, either one. I don't exchange that word. I just... Man is mankind to me, so that's... But when they cut me off on that freeway, I'm doing a self-inventory check when I keep myself from... And that whole car fills with blue smoke. I'm saying, Willie, hey, hold it, kid. Wish him well as he goes down the road. Wish everybody else he comes in contact with well. That's a spot check. I mustn't hold it and keep on nursing it till I get time to tend to it that night. No, because it's going to ruin the rest of my drive to where I'm going. It's going to ruin me after I get there. It gives us so many good suggestions. One over here on page 91. In all these situations, we need, look what we need. We need self-restraint, honest analysis of what is involved, a willingness to admit when the fault is ours, and an equal willingness to forgive when the fault is elsewhere. And that sentence, that end of that sentence, is just as important as admitting I'm wrong, wrong, wrong. We need to forgive when the fault is somebody else's too. Whenever I think I can ride herd on other people and what they do, I'm getting Willie into trouble. We need not be discouraged when we fall into the era of our old ways. Bill gives us so much room. For these disciplines are not easy. We shall look for progress, not for perfection. Our first objective will be to develop the development of self-restraint. This carries top priority rating. When we speak or act hastily or rashly, the ability to be fair-minded and tolerant evaporates on the spot. One unkind tirade or one willful snap judgment can ruin our relations with another person for a whole day, maybe a whole year, and you know, and I know, that maybe for a whole lifetime. Friendships need to be cherished. They need to be worked on. They can't just be taken for granted. God, we go out of this world, that's all we leave behind us is our friends and the people that have known us. One unkind tirade, one willful snap judgment, that can ruin it. Sometimes, you know, you can go back and say you're wrong and all is forgiven, and sometimes not. No matter how much that person loves you, when we reach out and hurt, that hurt sometimes can't be repaired. And look what it says here. Ooh. Nothing pays off like restraint of tongue and pen. We must avoid quick-tempered criticism and furious power-driven argument. The same goes for sulking or silent scorn. These are emotional booby traps baited with pride and vengefulness. Our first job is to sidestep the trap. When we are tempted by the bait, we should train ourselves to step back and think. Don't we love to step back and think? That doesn't come natural for us. We have to really work on that all the time. When I'm talking we, I'm talking alcoholic. Me, for we can neither think nor act to good purpose until the habit of self-restraint has become automatic. A lot of other good suggestions in there. Let's turn to page 96, step 11. Our principle here that we want to take into our lives and use it is awareness. We feel so unworthy sometime that we don't feel like we have that conscious contact with God. I've heard in meetings, and I felt that way myself. When I say I've heard in meetings, that it's because I've done the same thing myself. And I felt I just can't get that conscious contact. I just can't get it. You let me do one little kind thing for somebody, I got it. It isn't all that big a deal. That conscious contact was there. I can feel God pat me on the head too and say, Willie, you did good. That conscious contact's going to be there. Any time I go one centimeter out of my way to do something for somebody else. Not big. Not a big deal. Might be something simple as holding a door open for somebody.
I've gotten a lot of doors slammed in my face since all this women's lib stuff. They don't know I was born in the generation. I love for the man to hold the door open for me. So many of them gotten scowled at that they've almost quit holding doors. But just thanking the person, stopping long enough to give him a real thank you, not just, but to give him a thanks. Appreciate it. You can't get too far away from a conscious contact when you're paying attention, when you're being aware of everything around you and everybody that's going to come in contact with you. Praying only for the knowledge of His will and the power to carry that out. It says prayer and meditation are our principal means of conscious contact with God. Meditation comes in many forms. Thinking. Meditating means to think. And that's all. It doesn't mean high up on the mountaintop, down by the seashore. But to stop and think, you know, how can I make this day better? It says we AA are active folks, enjoying the satisfaction of dealing with the realities of life, usually for the first time in our lives, and strenuously trying to help the next alcoholic who comes along. So it isn't surprising that we often tend to slight serious meditation and prayer as something not really necessary. To be sure, we feel it is something that might help us to meet an occasional emergency. But at first, many of us are apt to regard it as a somewhat mysterious skill of the clergyman, from which we may hope to gain a second-hand benefit, or perhaps we don't believe in these things at all. But just taking the time in the beginning, if you can't get into the serious meditation, Rose told me, said, well, if you can't get into that, just sit down for a few minutes during the day. 15 minutes here, 10 minutes here. Just sit down for a minute and just think, am I comfortable with myself? Do I feel good? If I don't, what's going on, Willie? You're getting yourself tangled up here. She said, start with that kind of meditation. God knows you're talking to Him. He doesn't have to be formally addressed. Your power knows that you're talking to Him. When you're sitting there saying, you know, what? What's going on here? Why am I uncomfortable? Do I need to shape up this attitude? And sometimes we think that, you know, I wanted a preacher to pray me well. I wanted him to pray me good, you know. Because they come in. They come into hospitals and places like that, you know. Would you like for me to pray for you? So I just, you know, and a lot of times when we go to church, the preacher prays for us. I love the story of Sister Ignatius that helped so much there in town's hospital and attended to Bill and many, many others. She loved drunks. Beautiful little nun. She loved them. She said she was terribly tired one day because fooling with a whole ward full of drunks. And back in those days, they weren't the dainty, pretty little drunks that sometime we make calls on. And they're, you know, not in that bad a shape. But she said she was tired of fooling with those drunk men all day long. And they had made so many demands on her. And she was walking through they had them just bed after bed after bed. And she was walking through. And one of them reached out and grabbed her. That's when they wore the habits, the full black habits. And the beads swishing and swashing. And this drunk reached out or grabbed her habit. And he said, Sister, pray for me. And she said before she realized really how tired and spent she was, she jerked his hand away and said, pray for yourself. The Lord loves to hear from strangers. And God bless her, she told that on herself. And I just, you know, as we go along in this program, we have various spiritual experience for me has been that when something doesn't go like I want it to, that I still do the right thing. A spiritual experience for me is that little voice that tells me what to do when something goes wrong. I was sitting in a meeting one night, and a man popped up, and he said that he had had a real spiritual experience because he had gone to this concert, and he had gone around and around the block, and sure enough, somebody pulled out right in front of the concert hall, and he just zipped in there and got him a parking place. And that, you know, that was a real spiritual experience, that God had gotten him that parking place. Well, I call that, you know, God of the parking lot, because it's more likely with me that I have to park five blocks down the road and go to the concert and come back out and all my wheels on the car are gone. Okay? Let me see how I handle that. I mean, I think God and I have a real good sense of humor thing going here. He's more likely to let me come back and all four wheels are gone, just gone off the car. Now, Willie, what you going to do? It's how I handle situations that come up that become my spiritual experiences. Multitudes of them, not just one great big womp of a spiritual experience. Very few of us have Bill's vision. Most of ours, and he tells us in here, they're of the educational variety. The way we handle the foul weather, the way we handle all the little mishaps that are going to happen to us. And each time I can get through one of those things, that feel good that I have way down inside of Willie, that's another little spiritual experience for me. And you know, Sam Shoemaker was one of our such good friends, and he told Bill one time, he said, "Bill, you can't stay sober on yesterday's spiritual experience. You have to have a constant renewal of that experience." And that's what he was explaining to Bill, that, you know, he saw the lights and got the instant, and God saw that he got it that way, so that he could pass it on and on and on, clear down to the likes of us. But many of us have these spiritual experiences and don't recognize them if we're waiting for the big, big one. But all the little ones, how did we handle it? Did we handle it like we used to? Well, I'd go out, you know, just leave the car when I was drinking. I'd leave the car sitting right there, you know, and go to the bar and drink at them, at the low-down, dirty son of a guns that took my wheels off the car. I'd just get drunk at them. Now, that wouldn't do me any good. But if I can just, you know, go ahead and tend to my car, either leave it there and have it picked up later, think, Willie, think. And that's when I have a conscious contact. What's the best thing to do? What's the rational thing to do? What's the best thing that'll leave you in better shape? Conscious contact is not, I thought it was so mysterious at first. I thought it was some sort of a feeling that I was supposed to have that I didn't understand. Never had it, but I didn't realize that it can come in little doses, like good medicine. You don't take 8 pills every day, you just take the one, but it finally gets the illness to go away. A lot of good suggestions if you run into somebody or if you're having trouble with your step 11 and feel that you don't know what God's will is. Sometime we have to say, you know, what is the best thing I can do right now for everybody's sake? And when you can think of the best thing that you can do in a situation, you better know that's God's will. Because what does He want us to be? The best we can be. Not the best, but the best we can be. And that's when I know that I have, you know, God's will is in my life when I'm being the way he wants me to be. Step 12, we go to our last principle. We can work all these into our lives, into our daily lives. The principle of service. Not New York service, not that kind of service, but to be of utmost service to each other in our Alcoholics Anonymous fellowship and to every other human being that we happen to come in contact with. To be of service. That means he's groveling do-gooder. But if we can't do any good, be sure we don't do anything that's detrimental. So service is the last principle that we want. Having had a spiritual awakening as the results of these steps, each one of these principles that we have put into our lives and start working on, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics, and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. This first paragraph, and there's beautiful, beautiful things in this step 12. You know, step 12, he did an extensive job in the 12 and 12, just like he did in the big book. Step 12 is the only step that a whole chapter is devoted to in the big book. The only one. Working with others. All about step 12. And a lot of good suggestions that he comes up with in our 12 and 12 that he realized later on would help keep us in this direction that he wanted us to go, and that was to help other alcoholics the way we had been helped, to keep that chain going. And the first paragraph explains it so well. The joy of living is the theme of AA's 12th step. And action is its key word. Here we turn outward towards our fellow alcoholics who are still in distress. Here we experience the kind of giving that asks no rewards. Here we begin to practice all 12 steps of the program in our daily lives so that we and those about us may find emotional sobriety. When the 12th step is seen in its full implication, it's really talking about the kind of love, that has no price tag on it. None. That means to me, when I sponsor a gal and she stays sober for me and I get to thinking, you know, hot dog, she's really, and then 3 o'clock in the morning, really? And she's drunk. What's my love supposed to be for this girl? It's supposed to be the kind that has no price tag on it. She doesn't have to do. Well, if you'd have followed my suggestion, just you wouldn't have gotten into this mess. You shouldn't have gone back there and blah, blah, oh, That's the price tag I'm putting on the kind of love that I'm supposed to be giving her. Now, that doesn't mean that you fool away your time over and over, you know, year after year with somebody that's giving you, you know, nothing but drunkenness. But I figure if she's sober 2 or 3 months, that beats what she was before if she came into the program. My kind of love for you and for all the people in my life must not have a price tag on it. If I do this for you, you have to be grateful to me. If I'm kind to you, then you have to be kind to me, because you owe me. And that gets pretty hard sometimes. You know, I thought we were so unfortunate. I thought I was so unfortunate. When I had to admit that I was an alcoholic, I didn't realize how fortunate. You know, we have the only terminal illness that is immediately arrestable. The only one. We have the only fatal illness that we come out of stronger and happier and braver than when we went into it. Now, isn't that something? and I thought I was so unfortunate to become an alcoholic. I don't know what this is, but I always end everything. I don't know what this beautiful, beautiful program is, but I end with this piece out of the grapevine. A Canadian wrote it, and it was in a 57, 56 grapevine, somewhere in through there. But I'm going to close with this, and what we've been talking about, what this program really is, I don't know. And I don't think that anybody can ever really tell us what we've had in this room and what we're going to have here all weekend, what we had last night listening to Don. But I think this covers it better than anything. AA is a spirit. It cannot be touched, nor can it be completely understood. It's as wide as the world and yet small enough to fit snugly into the hearts and the minds of man. It's brought light where only darkness dwelt. It's given hope to the hopeless and help to those who yearned in despair. It's nourished forgiveness in those who knew no pity. It's given strength to the weak and humility to the strong. It's spurred to higher goals those who strove for nothing. It's taught patience to the hurried and action to the lazy. To youth, it's given vision, and to the aged, promise. To the lonely, companions, and to the restless, rest. To the sick, it's been a doctor, and to the dying, it has revived the desire to live. It has no judgment against the unteachable, nor has it praise for those who learn. To the outcast, it's been a family, and to the childless, it has given children. To the ignorant, wisdom, and to the wise, tolerance. It's given to all men that which is most precious. It's given a love of life and a love of truth with enough left over to share with each other. Thank you for letting me share with you.